Has your doctor said one of the following things to you? Oh, obesity is just a disease. We have pills for that. Or type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, that's a chronic progressive disease. There's nothing you can do about that. I've got some pills and some injections. Or fatty liver. Oh, you've got fatty liver. That's just a disease. There's no fault of your own. Nothing you can do about it. I've got a pill for that. Well, I've got a special guest with me today, and we're going to be talking about a proper human diet. Many doctors receive no nutrition training whatsoever. And I suspect that Dr. Eads, much like me, got very little nutrition training in medical school. But since his graduation, he, much like I, have basically lived in the nutrition and the archaeology and the anthropology and the paleoanthropological literature to try to rediscover what is a proper human diet. If you eat a proper human diet, will it reverse these chronic progressive diseases that are not reversible? My answer is yes, and I think his answer is yes or two. Yes, also, please welcome Dr. Michael Eads with me. I wish we could all give him a round of applause, but he couldn't hear it, but you can. We're welcome to. Dr. Michael Eads, welcome.
Hey, great to be here, Ken.
I'm honored to have you with me here today. I'm hoping that we have a large audience. All you guys, please share this around on social media immediately and hit that thumbs up and leave us a comment really quickly to tell the all-powerful algorithm that this is important and people need to have access to this. I've got your bio in the show notes, doctor, but quickly sum up your bona fides for everyone.
Well, I started out in undergraduate school in engineering, became a civil engineer, worked as a civil engineer for, 5 or 6 years, and then decided that I wanted to go back to medical school. So did that, and then started out in surgical training. And then when I was waiting for my wife to graduate from medical school, she was a few years behind me. I spent a lot of time practicing in ERs. And then when she got out and got through her training, we opened up one of the first chains of urgent care centers in the country. And we ran those. They were in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we ran those for a number of years. And kind of early on in that, I decided I wanted to specialize in something. And the thing that helped me along is that I became obese myself. And so I started thinking, well, you know, here's a good thing that I can look into. So I started delving into the research in obesity, and it just all has come from there. And then we created this diet that was successful for a lot of patients, and we wrote about that. And now we've written, 13 or 14 books on diet and nutrition, and have another one in the works, and do a lot of talks, and that's about it.
I think that your life prior to medical school and being a doctor is very important. And so you were an engineer before, right? And then, or at least studied engineering, but then you were an ER physician. And I think right. That combination just makes you look at the world a little differently than the average internist or the average endocrinologist. And I was a redneck country boy and was worked in just the menial labor sector for many years, then went to medical school. And then I was an ER doc for about the first 7 years of my practice as well. Yeah. So that may be something that warps our brain to the extent where we see nutrition like you and I do. I've got some of your slides prepared, and I want you to just take the floor and explain to people that a proper human diet is knowable from the literature, and not just nutrition literature. You got to dig deeper than that. It is doable, in that we can still do it, even though we're living a modern life. We can still eat that ancient diet that gave us our really preeminent health before a certain time in history, and that it is sustainable. You'll get every vitamin, every mineral, every amino acid, every fatty acid that you need in the right amounts if you follow this way of eating. So Dr. Michael Eads, you have the floor, and you just tell me which slides you want, and I'll pull them up.
All right. Well, you can pull up the first one. The Donaldson slide.
Yes.
And
got it.
This is a great quote. During the millions of years that our ancestors lived by hunting, every weakling who could not maintain perfect health on fresh fat, meat, and water was bred out. Now, Donaldson's an interesting guy because he was an old time New York physician, practiced in the city. And he also practiced in World War One. I mean, that's how old he is. He kind of cut his teeth practicing in World War One. And his book, Strong Medicine, he talks about, you know, how awful it was taking care of people who had had mustard gas in World War One, which was really dreadful. And their deaths were really dreadful. And the worst part of it was that they knew they were coming. Even though they weren't at death's door right at the moment, they knew what the progression was. So it was really a terrible thing. But he did a lot of experimenting around, and then he ran into Wilhelmer Stephenson. And out on Stephenson's home in Long Island, he went out there and talked to Stephenson about diet. Now, I'm assuming a lot of you know who Stephenson was. He was an Arctic explorer and lived years and years and years with the Inuit in Alaska and basically lived there on an all-meat diet. And then he did this famous experiment with another Stephenson himself wasn't Scandinavian. He was born in the United States, but of Icelandic parents. And he had another, I think, a Danish guy that went in with him. And they went into Bellevue Hospital in New York and went on an all-meat diet. Because at this time, back in the 1920s, everybody thought, you know, if you don't eat fruits and vegetables, you're going to die. And so anyway, Stephenson did that, proved they weren't going to die. All of his blood parameters improved. He lost weight. It was kind of the picture of health after he came out of this. I think it was a year-long deal. And it generated, I don't know, maybe a dozen medical papers in the literature back then. But anyway, he was a big believer in meat eating because he had seen that it didn't hurt the Inuit. So he figured it wasn't going to hurt him. And indeed, it didn't. So he basically taught this to Donaldson. And then Donaldson, in his practice, almost anybody that came in with anything, he would put them on an all-meat diet. Now, this was back in the 50s and 60s. And he had great results on it. Anyway, that's what his book is about his practice. And if you're the least bit politically correct, you do not want this book because it's filled with things that would get him canceled in a heartbeat if you were to write them today, but it's a book of its time. But it does have a lot of really useful information and interesting information in it. But anyway, this quote that I pulled out of there basically sums up this whole idea that we've had, 2.4 million years since we were Lucy, since we were upright walking hominins, to have the forces of natural selection work on us. And they bred out those that didn't do well on a diet that was basically meat and a little bit of vegetation, going all the way back to Australopithecus afarensis.
Yeah, and there was actually one of the hominid species now extinct, Heidelbergensis, I think is the right one, that looks like it was predominantly a plant and cellulose eater. Yeah. Had a very prominent sagittal ridge, huge socket for masseter muscles. And that hominid is now extinct.
Yeah, that was the line that tried to go vegetarian.
That's exactly right.
We've got a slide in there on that. And that's a pretty interesting way that they determined what had happened to that particular lineage. But anyway, this book by Donaldson, I didn't really read until after I'd already gotten going in all this. And the book that really kicked me into this, my wife and I were in the process of writing Protein Power at the time. And I was just doing some casual reading one night in bed, and I came across this book called Napoleon's Glands. And it was just a chapter after chapter after chapter of these little vignettes about different weird things in medicine. And it came across this chapter about this guy named Michael Zimmerman, who was a pathologist in Detroit at Wayne State University, who was dissecting mummies. And what I read in this was that the ancient Egyptians who lived, 1,200 years before sugar was ever even on the scene, had all the same diseases that we see today. They had heart disease, they had diabetes, they were obese, they had just a whole host of issues that are the same issues that we essentially had. In an earlier part of my life, I had really gotten into Egyptology, and so I knew what the Egyptians ate, basically. They were on a grain-based diet, and that just sort of gobsmacked me. And so that sent me off on this whole rabbit trail of looking up the Paleolithic diet and learning about the Paleolithic diet and learning about agriculturalists versus hunter-gatherers. And it's really interesting because, anthropologists can look what they call a set of remains. They can look at the skeletal remains of an ancient group that were anatomically humans like we are. I'm not talking about even pre-humans, but anatomically humans like we are. And they can look, and I mean, in 5 seconds, they can tell you if they were hunter-gatherers or if they were agriculturalists, because hunter-gatherers were taller. They had less signs of disease. They had better teeth. They had thicker bones. Just a whole host of signs that they can look at and tell you. And when agriculture came along, it was kind of good for man, I suppose, in an overall sense, because it allowed us to have divisions of labor and have a few people raise food for the many, whereas hunter-gatherers kind of all went out and gathered on their own. But it was kind of a devolution in terms of human health. And we can look at the slide, the one that says Kleiber.
Okay. Oh, yes, Kleiber's line. First, if you don't mind, I want to take a comment from one of the viewers. I hear this argument very often, the fallacy of this is what our ancestors always ate, which he's assuming that you're making the fallacy, the appeal to nature. But they also died off at age 30 on average, so it doesn't matter if they filled their arteries with cholesterol, they burned it off, or died. How would you answer that? You're just appealing to nature. This has no bearing on modern humans. What would your reply to that be?
Well, Stephen Austad, who's my favorite anti-aging researcher in the book, and his book is the one that I like the best, he shows, based on the mortality rate doubling time, that and looking at ancient remains, that plenty of people way back in the day, I mean, even Neanderthals, lived up until their 60s and 70s. So the fact that everybody died at 30 is just not true. I mean, they had diseases that we have antibiotics for. They had trauma that we could now deal with. So a lot of people were killed off, but they didn't prematurely age and die at 30. If they survived infections and if they survived trauma, they could live to 60 or 70 years old. And there are plenty of cases and evidence of that in the anthropological literature. So that itself is kind of a myth.
Yes, totally agree. Okay, I've got Kleiber's line up now. If you
actually
want to talk about that.
Expensive. There you go.
Okay,
you got it. The expensive tissue hypothesis. This is a paper that came out by Leslie Aiello and Peter Wheeler, and it came out in the early to mid 90s, I guess. And when I got a hold of this, I thought I had died and gone to heaven, because this is really an interesting paper, because what they looked at was why there was a rapid expansion in brain size and a devolution in gut size. And what they showed, and it was kind of a thought experiment. And now you can go to Kleiber's law. And okay. there's this physiologist that was around forever. He was from Switzerland originally, but he spent his entire career at University of California at Davis. And he measured the metabolic rate versus the mass of everything he could lay his hands on. I mean, horses, elephants, dogs, cats, mice, you name it, he measured it. And he found out that there was this linear relationship between the two, so that if you knew the mass of something, you could figure out what its metabolic rate was. And just about everything, including humans, fell right on this line. And so by knowing that, you could go back and pull up anthropological specimens of ancient people, and they would fit on this line too. So you could basically calculate what their metabolic rates are based on their mass. And let's see, let's go over to the, what's the other one? What's the next one? The expensive tissue, the expected organ mass.
Oh, expected organ.
Yeah, there you go. And what they did when they did that is they, based on what they expected, which is on the right, given a 65 kilogram primate / human, they expected it to break out like it does on the right, where these are what, well, this is the sort of the metabolism or the metabolic rates of the various organs. And if you look at apes, they come out like this. But when you look at ancient man, that's about the same size as ape, it comes out different. There's a much larger brain. And because of the constraints of this Kleiber line, something had to give. And so what gave was the gut. And so what they're hypothesis in this was that this is when people switched to meat eating because they got much more, much denser nutrition, much higher quality nutrition that didn't require the same digestive capability as a lot of plant food did. And so that allowed their brains to expand. And so that's what's called the expensive tissue hypothesis. And I talked to Leslie Aiello about this once, and she told me that she almost couldn't get this paper published. And it was in cultural anthropology. She couldn't get it published. And they went back and forth and back and forth. And at the last minute, kind of said, okay, we'll publish the damn thing. And now it's the most cited paper in that entire journal, which
I find kind of interesting. I love this article. I'm not even going to tell you how many times I've read this article by Aiello.
I know it's a great article. Now what happens? Let's go to the one, let's go to the, I got to look, I've got these on a different computer. Let's go to the increases in hominid cranial capacity.
Is that the one?
There you go. That's the one. Yep. You can see over time how much that's increased as humans have developed. I mean, it just went skyrocketing up, and that inflection point is right about the time that we really switched to a meat-eating diet. And when we switched, we basically switched to scavengers, which we'll talk about in a minute. And what's really interesting about scavenging is that chimpanzees, which are our closest relatives in the sort of the primate line, do not scavenge. I mean, they do eat meat. They kill some of these little monkeys and eat them, and they do eat some meat, but they don't scavenge, which is interesting because early humans really did scavenge. And so let's take a look at, the 65% plant foods. There you go.
All right.
Kind of got these out of order. Now there was a paper written called Man the Hunter way back in the day that's kind of been disproven now by some work that Lauren Cordain and some other people did. But they said that back in the day that people got 65% of their calories from plants. And if you look at these plants, and you can see how much of any of these it would take to get 65% of your diet. And a lot of primates do that. And you got to also remember that these are all plants that have been Luther Burbanked. I mean, I pulled these numbers out of sort of current nutritional, you know, dietary manuals. And back in the day, there was a lot more fiber in the food. So it would take actually a lot more to get these 3,000 calories out of these than it did back then. But you can see the vast mass of that. And if you'll switch over to the abdominal changes, there you go. You can see the human on the left and the Australopithecus on the right. And you can see how even the chest cavity has changed because the Australopithecus was wide at the bottom to accommodate this large protruding abdomen. Whereas the modern humans, it's a narrower, smaller waist. And then go to the one that's the, what would it be called? Just click on through. You got it the last time. There you go. Yep. You can see the gorilla on the right. You can see a chimpanzee on the left with even a big belly. And the guy in the middle is a true hunter-gatherer. This is a guy from Norway, a Norwegian doctor that went to Greenland and went to the interior of Greenland back in the 1930s and found some true hunter-gatherers that were living the actual Inuit lifestyle. And he measured everything he could possibly measure on them and got pictures of a lot of them, both male and female. And this is a fairly typical one. He's 26 years old, but you see what a real hunter-gatherer looks like. And he does not have a giant protruding abdomen.
And let me point out, Doctor, the gorilla and the chimpanzee in these pictures are not obese. Mm-mm. Their gut is supposed to be like that because exactly. They are hindgut fermenters. They have to have a huge cecum and large intestine to break down all the cellulose that they eat. Well, the bacteria, they have to have room for bacteria to break that down so that they can actually get nutrition. Also, the chimps absolutely hunt meat, and we really don't know how often. There's been some research that says it's probably infrequent, but when you start looking at how long the researchers actually spent with the clade of chimpanzees, they would go in and spend maybe 2 days with them. And then they would, every few months, they'd go spend a couple of days. So they weren't with them every day. And then for gorillas, even though they have that huge hindgut and that huge gut to ferment in, they still engage in a practice called coprophagia, which means they eat their own poop. And they have to do that regularly in order to get the B12 and other B vitamins that the bacteria made, but their large intestine wasn't able to absorb. And then finally, on the fruit and vegetable chart, keep in mind, everyone watching this, that human beings have been selectively breeding fruits and vegetables even before recorded history, even before 8,000, 12,000 years ago. And there's even zoological evidence that animals, not humans, but animals selectively breed fruits. They always choose, just like we do, they choose the biggest, fattest, sweetest fruit. And therefore, that seed gets deposited at an ideal location, often in a pile of poop. So it's fertilized. And so not only do humans crossbreed and selectively breed, but animals do that as well. And so the plants that we have today are nothing like the plants that were before 12, 15,000 years ago.
True.
All right. Which one's
next? All right. Let's see. Okay. So now here we come. This is how do we determine if we're going to try to find the diet of early man, how do we figure it out? And there are a million different ways that you can do it. And people have looked at all of these things to determine what it is. And some of them are more accurate than the others, but I want to look at, we're going to go through just a couple of them while we're in this interview today. But let's look at the first one, is stable isotope analysis. But before we do that, I think we've got a slide that's called determining scavenged food. Do we have that?
I don't know if we have that. No,
we got that.
We do. Okay, let me see. There it is.
We talked about humans being scavengers to begin with, and this anthropologist called Rana Pobinar went to Africa and did some work there looking at lion kills and to try to determine how much meat and fat and calories that people could get from lion kills. And it you might imagine it's a function of how many lions are in on the kill. Sometimes it's just one. Sometimes it's a bunch of them. The more lions, the less stuff there is left. But you can see from that graphic on the top, the white part is the flesh. I think that's what this is. That's the flesh that's available. And what she found out is that it doesn't take very long on a wildebeest carcass to get 2,200 calories, which is about like 4 Big Macs. And on a zebra carcass, now these are averages, it doesn't take very long. She didn't spend all day doing this. She was kind of acting like she was a scavenger and going out and with tools that they would have had back then to get this. And you can get, you know, a little over 6,000 calories off of a zebra carcass on average. So
after the carnivores are finished with it.
Yeah, right. After they've eaten it, their fill, and gone away, and they go in and just scavenge this. And that's
kind of, doctor, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think she included in her calculations the brain and the bone marrow. There's a great paleoanthropological researcher, Jessica somebody, right. You may know her last name.
Yeah.
And she's got an excellent paper with some good, robust evidence that probably was our first foray into carnivory.
Oh, yeah.
Because after the lions and hyenas were finished, we would go in with a big fat rock and we would crush the calvarium, get the brains. We would break the femur and the humerus, get the bone marrow. And if you added those calories to what this is just available flesh.
This
on the
is
bone.
Just available flesh. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you're right. It would be 10,000 calories on a wildebeest.
Yeah. And that's Jessica. What, she's at Harvard. I can't remember her last name.
Yeah, I can't remember her name.
But anyway, that does not include the brain nor the marrow. So, thanks for bringing that up.
Absolutely.
And then what do we have? What do we have next on this thing? I kind of put these.
This is the stable isotope.
Okay. The stable isotope analysis. This is one of the more accurate ways of determining what the diet of early man was. And we've got, you know, every atom, you know, a carbon atom has got a certain number of electrons and a certain number of protons and a certain number of neutrons. And the neutrons vary, and that means that they're isotopes. And 12 is the regular one. Carbon 13 is another one. Carbon 14 is another one that we've all heard about because we use that for radiocarbon dating, as they call it. And that one is not stable and it decays over time. So it doesn't work for us on this, but 13 is a stable one. And people know what the ratios of the 12 to 13 are. And you can tell by the change of that ratio what people ate in terms of kind of plant food. And the same thing for protein and N14 and N15. N14 is the normal standard. N15 is a little bit bigger, but you take these things, you get into the collagen, you determine, or the, you know, the tooth enamel, and you determine the ratio between these. And it's a number that's called per mil. It's a, you know, delta C13 per mil. And that tells you the difference in those. And by comparing that to sort of normals in that area at the time, then you can tell basically what animals or people there ate.
And I want everyone listening to just contemplate this. The average doctor gets very little, if any, training in nutrition. But that same doctor gets zero training in archaeology, anthropology, or paleoanthropology. Zero, none. My opinion is they absolutely need at least a review course in anthropology, paleoanthropology, because that's important, how we evolved up to this point in time. And so the stable isotope analysis, I've read so many papers about this and tried to wrap my brain around it. It gets quite technical. So we've got the guy who can explain it to us in common sense terms. So if you have a family member, a friend who's struggling with their health and their diet, please share this video with them right now. This information is invaluable for them and they don't even know they need it. Just like the average doctor has no idea he needs to be studying anthropology.
Right. And they have no idea that this can even be determined.
Exactly.
And so you just take these things, put them in a mass spectrometer, and you can really glean a lot of information. And one of the things, what's the next slide that we've got on here? One of the next things that comes up is you can see over time, you've got a C3 carbon or a C3 plant food and a C4 plant food. Now, C3 plant foods are wheat and barley and millet. And those are all, you know, older grains that even pre-wheat, when wheat was just grass, it had in photosynthesis, the whole photosynthetic process is a little bit more difficult for plants to use the carbon 13 than it is the carbon 12. So it would be a lower amount in that. And when maize came along, it uses a whole kind of a different type of photosynthesis where it doesn't really matter. So they've got a lot more carbon 13 in that. And so you can see over time on this graph, how on the left, back in the days that people ate grasses, that their C3 was predominant. And then when maize came along, you can see that really take off. So these are just some of the things that you can find with this stable isotope analysis.
Yes. So when a doctor or a dietitian tells a patient, oh, humans have always ate predominantly plants and you're going to do best on a plant-based diet or a vegetarian or a vegan diet, that reveals a complete and utter ignorance to this information right here, which I'm not saying that doctor's bad or evil. They're just currently ignorant of this information. Yeah. This stuff is known. And so in paleoanthropological circles, it is considered self-evident that human beings for at least 350,000 years, but if you go back even further, for really probably 3.5 million years, our ancestors have been super carnivores, meaning that 70% of their food intake was animal products. And so if any doctor says, oh, plant-based is best, that's what we've always eaten, that's just ignorance talking. And still be respectful to that doctor, but that they've revealed to you they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, and that was back in the, you know, they're thinking 300 or 400 years ago when a lot of people ate plants, but we were a fraction of the size we were 200,000 years ago.
Yes.
And had a fraction of the bone cortical thickness and had tons of tooth decay. And I didn't put them up on here, but I've got a million pictures of just rampant tooth decay and people, even before the days of sugar, who ate plant-based diets. But
yeah, anyway, absolutely. And I think we do have at least one slide about that. And here's more about the Delta N15.
Yeah, now here's when we start looking at protein. And this is these nitrogen isotope ratios increase with each trophic level. So you've got a certain amount of nitrogen in the native plants. And when herbivores eat those, they concentrate the nitrogen. Just like, you know, in the ocean, little fish eat littler fish and in turn get consumed by larger fish and larger fish. We've all seen the diagrams going back up. And when that happens, we concentrate mercury. And that's why, you know, if you eat a lot of big fish, you get more mercury than if you eat a bunch of sardines. And it's the same thing with this nitrogen in the stable isotope ratio analysis. You start out, the plants have a certain amount of nitrogen because plants do contain nitrogen. When herbivores eat them, they concentrate the nitrogen and they have about a plus 3 per mil. Now, when omnivores, I've got this baboon up there, which is kind of an omnivore. When omnivores eat herbivores, they concentrate it even more and they go up another 3 per mil. And then when carnivores eat omnivores, they concentrate it as well, and they concentrate it from herbivores. And so those are the trophic levels. And if we can go on to the next slide.
So you're saying that with the stable isotope analysis, it's not questionable whether we ate C3 plants or C4 plants. It's not questionable whether we ate very little meat or a lot of meat. That's pretty much quantifiable in the fossil record. We can do the stable isotope analysis. Also, I know they're doing some work with strontium isotopes.
Right.
And to really hone down, is it seafood? Is the meat coming from the ocean or freshwater, or is it coming from red meat? And so, again, I got to tell everybody, if your doctor says, oh, we don't really know what people ate in the past, but it looks like plant-based is best, that's just ignorance talking. They just don't currently know better, but I'm going to leave it up to all you guys to educate your doctor, because I know a lot of people who have done that. What are we looking at here, Doc?
Well, to go back to what you just said before, one of the things that happened, humans were such efficient hunters that they ended up hunting out most of the large game in areas where they stayed for any length of time. And so then they had to rely on, sorry about that ping, I don't know how to turn it off. Anyway, they had to rely on, they turned more to seafood or aquatic food, you know, fish, turtles, salamanders, whatever they could get like that. And you can actually see that in this nitrogen too, because sea animals concentrate it differently than do big land animals. So you can tell that as well. But this is a picture of a particular cave from a little over 12,000 years ago. And I didn't cherry pick this. Ken can tell you, he's looked at this literature too. The literature is just crawling with these studies. And this is just one that I put up because I had the data for it and it was nice, but you can see these dark colored columns over here. The three to the left, one of them's a wild horse, the other's an auroch, which is a prehistoric cow, another one's a red deer. Then you get up to the green one, and that's an Arctic fox, and an Arctic fox is a total carnivore. And then the four to the right are humans. So humans are what we call hypercarnivores, because if you remember that previous slide, we went from plants to herbivores to omnivores to carnivores. Well, you can take it one notch above that if you have super carnivores or hypercarnivores, because those are carnivores that ate all the other stuff, plus they ate carnivores. So that concentrated it even more. So humans, and I've got a bunch of slides that I didn't put in here or didn't send to Ken, that the same thing is true of Neanderthals. They were super or hypercarnivores. So basically early man was a hypercarnivore.
And you know, a lot of people don't have any problem admitting, yeah, Neanderthals were meat eaters. Because that didn't offend them, because they don't feel like they're a direct descendant of the Neanderthal. But if you start saying that Homo sapiens sapien was also a super or a hyper carnivore, they immediately become defensive, because now you're talking about their grandmother and they don't like that. But literally this slide is, and you're right, there are scores of studies show this exact same pattern, that the humans, not Neanderthals, but Homo sapiens sapien, us, from 12,000 years ago in this case, but there's multiple examples from 20, 50, 100,000 years ago where we had a higher nitrogen isotope level than foxes or coyotes mm-hmm. or wolves. Mm-hmm. So we mm-hmm. were not only eating all the herbivores, we were probably eating some of the carnivores as well.
We had to be. We had to be to concentrate it at a higher level. And so that's, I mean, you know, you may not like it, but early humans were, our ancestors were hypercarnivores. And that went on for a long time. I mean, relative to modern life, which is just a blink of the eye in terms of evolutionary history. And we're talking about going back 200,000 years to anatomically modern humans. Some people say 300,000 years. So that's a lot longer than just the last two or three or 400 years, or even the last millennia,
exactly.
when you're looking at it. And you don't have time to genetically change that quickly. Right. So basically, we are carnivores.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize that our DNA has not changed in any appreciable amount that from our ancestors here 12,380 years ago, but even our ancestors 100,000 years ago, you could give them a bath, shave them, put them in a suit and put them on Times Square. Nobody would give them a second look because they were human just like we are. And so again, I saw another comment about the appeal to nature. It's kind of a foolish argument when you start to look at this kind of data, because it would be analogous to saying, well, yeah, I know cows ate grass, you know, for the last million years, but that's just the appeal to nature. You can feed grass, cows, lollipops and ding dongs and donuts. It's perfectly fine. It's not going to make them sick at all. Well, any farmer, any vet, any common sense human is going to know immediately that you're an idiot if you say something like that. So be careful about your appeal to nature argument. This is not an appeal to nature. This is an appeal to science. See, that there's the citation down at the bottom of the slide.
Yeah. And there, and as I say, there are a lot of these studies and everyone who does them finds the same thing. So it's not like that there's just one or two out there. I mean, once the floodgates were opened, and people started looking at these from, you know, in every ancient set of remains that they can get their hands on.
Exactly.
Okay, here's the here is kind of the evolution of man. And I put these, I mean, sometimes the ones that go a couple of different ways, there's some argument if it went one way or if it went the other way. And when I put these, I kind of put them in their relative sizes. And if you go back to the left, that's Lucy, Astropithecus afarensis. And this is the line that became more and more modern that ended up with modern Homo sapiens sapiens. And there was another branch that the first one of which was Australopithecus robustus that really puzzled anthropologists for a while until they figured out what was going on, because they were more primitive in look. Look at Australopithecus africanus down at the bottom, the second one from afarensis, the first one you see. Look at how much more modern that skull was than the robustus, and they existed at the same time. And so they said, well, this is a much more, you know, the africanus is so much more modern looking, but the robustus stayed the same, and it looks much more primitive. It's got the heavy brows, got the heavy jaws, the heavy teeth. They couldn't figure out what the big difference was. And they finally realized when they developed this whole science of tooth analysis. And that's, I mean, you talk about getting in the weeds, tooth analysis, enamel analysis, and ancient remains is phenomenal what they can pull out of that, because they've done experiments with all kinds of living things and with modern teeth and subjected them to chewing action on anything you can think of. And everything it is, whether it's a grass, whether it's a bone, whether it's meat, it doesn't matter what it is, it leaves its own unique mark in the enamel. So now they're really good at this enamel analysis when they can take these ancient things and they can see what they ate. And they figured out that this Australopithecus robustus and downstream from there were basically vegetarians. They ate, you know, roots and shoots and sticks and kind of heavy, coarse plant food. And they died out. That entire line died out. And the line that followed the meat eating path lived on to ultimately become us.
So the hominid line that tried to eat a vegan diet wound up, and you see up at the top of the slide, the sign that says right. Dead end.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they just, that line ended. And what was funny is that as it went down the line, I just showed one intermediate. Well, I showed the one and then the dead end. But if you really get into the literature and go down this line, as they go down the line, they became more and more primitive in their look, but based on radiocarbon dating, they were more modern. And that was the big conundrum that they couldn't figure out until they realized what was going on, and that they had actually, that they were more modern, but they just were strictly vegetarians, and that whole line died out.
Absolutely. SL says, are crickets part of the proper human diet? I would say yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Between plants and animals, yeah. I think I'd much prefer you eat beef, butter, bacon, and eggs. But if you can't get that, I think crickets are preferable to kale. What do you say, Doctor?
Absolutely. I mean, people have eaten insects and slugs and worms and stuff that we would really turn up our noses at forever.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
And there's a myth out there that primates can't absorb chitin, which is the cellulose-like hard shell covering insects. Absolutely false. There are multiple primates that eat a large percentage of their diet is anthropods, is insects. They eat the hell out of them. And human beings, there's ample anthropological evidence that humans have eaten copious amounts of insects. And then archaeology as well. And then even extant humans now, today in many cultures, it's still considered perfectly permissible. So I'm not advocating that you guys eat the bugs, okay? Yeah. That's not the point here. The point here is that in the right situation, yes, crickets and mealworms can absolutely be part of a proper human diet if you don't have access to nutrient-dense animal food.
Right. Yeah, oh, absolutely. I have a paper somewhere. In fact, I was looking for it the other day and couldn't lay my hands on it, about these people in Utah that gathered these crickets and how many calories that they could gather in just a couple of hours. And it was an enormous number of calories. So, and so I'm sure that people have eaten crickets and grasshoppers and worms and who knows what since time immemorial.
Yeah. And let's just let's speak plainly here. I don't think anyone should ever be forced to eat bugs. I think that should absolutely never happen. The only time in the past that our ancestors ate bugs is when they had no other choice.
Yeah.
And so I fear that if the economy keeps going the direction it's going in, there may be a certain subset of the population on this earth somewhere in some country who will be very happy to eat the bugs. And you won't even have to make them because their hunger will drive that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, another thing that I don't really talk about here, but one time I was in Norway, way up in Norway, and up in the glaciers, and I saw this stream trickling down off a hill, and I got up and I got a sample of the water and brought it home and had it tested, and the water back then was really high in mineral content too, and that's what they drank.
Absolutely.
About that today. They drink this bottled water and, back in the day, the water was just filled with minerals.
Absolutely. And when I talk about the daily mineral drops, people are like, well, why do you have to supplement? And how's that part of a proper human diet? And I'm like, because Bubba, 50,000 years ago, people were drinking stream water.
Yeah.
They would drink spring water if they could find a damn spring. But any country boy will tell you, you don't just go over every hillside and find a spring, but you do find mud puddles and ponds and brackish water. And those things are full of electrolytes and minerals, as well as Giardia and other things. But our gut could tolerate it back then because we drank that water on a daily basis. And so the modern water in most cities and in most municipalities, the only minerals in there are chloride and fluoride. That's the only minerals you're going to get in that water.
Right.
And you may not want those minerals. And so Nisha and I, we got a reverse osmosis unit, and then we put the daily minerals in that. So we make our own mineral water, thus mimicking, again, what our ancestors did millennia ago.
Right. Because when people go through the ancestral diet, they often forget about the water component of it because they had to drink water too.
Absolutely.
And it was usually loaded with stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, lots of stuff.
All right. Now, I'm going to switch over. These shifts are kind of clunky because I have a whole slideshow that I put on about this, and I've just plucked a few slides out. But another way, so we've got the stable isotope analysis to determine what people ate. And then we've got actually what's called paleopathology that determines what people ate. And this is a great study. And again, there are many, many, many studies like this. This is not the only one. This is about a group of hunter-gatherers from comparing people from about 2,500 years ago to people about 500 years ago before contact with, you know, with Europeans. And this was all in Kentucky, which is close to where Ken is, a state away. And then, but then there was another one up in Ohio. There was even a greater data set than this that showed the same thing. But anyway, when you look at these remains, and this was a pretty good study because they had almost 600 skeletons in various ages. And what you can see at the top is that real moth-eaten skull looking with those little, you know, holes in it. And it's just kind of grungy looking. It's not slick. That's called parotid hyperostosis. And that parotid hyperostosis comes from a vitamin C deficiency. Iron deficiency anemia. And it's sore and it hurts, and people who have it are miserable. And when you find skulls like that, you find that these people were iron deficient. And when they looked at these two different sets of remains that were essentially not right on top of one another, but separated by not all that far and probably the same genetic material, the hunter-gatherers lived 2,500 years ago, and the farmers lived about 500 years ago. And I don't have the slide in there, but if you look at what they ate, you know, the hunters ate essentially meat supplemented but a few berries and a little bit of wild fruit when it was in season. The agriculturalist had squash and corn and, you know, all the things that agriculturalists had back then. And they supplemented with a little bit of turtle meat, strangely enough. But anyway, the farmers had way more. The hunters had none, but the farmers had this hyperostosis, parotid hyperostosis. If you see the bottom one inside the eye socket, that's called Cribra orbitalia. That's that same moth-eaten look in there. And that's also from iron deficiency anemia. And it is miserable. And 50% of children had that in the farmers, none in the hunters.
So the farming culture of these American natives would have been basically predominantly a corn and vegetable diet. And the hunter-gatherer society would have been eating predominantly a meat-based or meat-heavy diet.
Right. And the thing that makes this study interesting and important, I think, is because a lot of people say, well, you know, agriculturalists have more disease because they're in a fixed location. Hunter-gatherers don't, because they're always out roaming around. They're always, you know, they're nomads. They're moving all over the place. So they don't, they're not going to get sick. They're not going to get the infections that you get when you're crammed together. And these people were crammed together. They lived in villages and roamed to hunt. And so this is one where you're not comparing people who are fixed in one place with nomads. These groups were both fixed in place.
Yes. So that's excellent point.
And so the next slide, if you got it. Now, this is another sign. You can see these horizontal lines on teeth. This is called enamel hypoplasia. And enamel hypoplasia indicates a serious nutritional stress when people are growing. And if there's a severe nutritional stress, they don't lay down the enamel on the teeth like they normally do. And so you can see, and so when you see that, that's a sign of really a time of bad nutritional stress. And they found that it was vastly more prominent among farmers than it was among the hunters. Next slide. Now, these are going to be hard to see, I don't have a pointer, but they're these little kind of whitish horizontal lines at the ends of these bones. And those are called Harris lines. They're above the joint, and they're these horizontal lines, and those are called Harris lines, and those are growth arrest lines. And interestingly enough, and those are indicators of mild nutritional stress, and those were actually more common in the hunters than they were in the agriculturalists. So it showed that hunters had times of mild nutritional stress, whereas the agriculturalists had times of really severe nutritional stress. And so that's... Those are again, another way that, people can look at these and tell not precisely what they ate, but whether they had periods of nutritional stress or, lack of, proper nutrition. And tooth decay was rampant among farmers, average of 7 caries, a lot of tooth loss in children. There was an average of under 1 cavity in the hunters, and some tooth loss in old age. And you can see on the skull down there, the skull at the top, if you see that kind of eroded area way down in the, bottom of the lower jaw, that is a tooth abscess. And that's a, an infection, a pus pocket that's around the root of that tooth. And that would have been incredibly painful. And not only that, could lead to septicemia and actually kill the person, and for all I know, may have on this.
Yeah. But, and that's one thing that we, have these discrete different tribes or different assortment of people. And our commenter earlier said, well, they all died at 30. Well, I guarantee you this guy who was eating the corn and the plants, when he got that dental abscess, he probably died. Yes. Yeah. And he was eating a plant-based diet, but he died of dental abscesses. And this is something that I don't understand where the American Dental Association is on this, or the American Association of Pediatric Dentists. Where the hell are these guys? If they really wanted to prevent childhood cavities and childhood dental abscesses, stop the fruit juice, stop the grain, stop the sugar. Literally, there would be one kid out of 200 that would have one cavity every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of people immediately point at the profit motive and say, well, yeah, but then they'd be out of a job if they started really pointing that out. But I believe the average dentist is ethical and moral. I don't think that they would say, I'd rather make my Mercedes payment and fill and pull teeth that, are unnecessarily decayed. I think if they really knew the information that Dr. Eads was talking about right here, I think they would give not only different advice, but they would give that advice more robustly. Because it's one thing to say, oh, don't eat sticky candy. But it's another thing to say, if you don't want to have a cavity, do not eat grains. Do not eat corn. Do not eat sugar. Do not drink fruit juice. And you just won't have any cavities.
Yeah.
I think that would hit the average patient a lot differently, don't you, doctor?
Yep. Don't eat sticky carbs. You know, I've never had a dentist tell me that. You know, I've had them tell me to brush and floss and all that, but I've never had one say, look, don't eat all that crap. Yep. And it's interesting because they're under, the average was less than 1 cavity in the hunters. And these were people that lived up to, you know, old age. And some of them, and they had, you know, they would use their teeth as tools. So they sometimes had wear from that,
right?
But they didn't have cavities, and that's really interesting. I mean, how many people in our society now live to be even 40 or 50 and not have a single cavity?
Absolutely, it's very, very rare.
No toothbrushes, no fluoride, no nothing.
Yeah, you got to have your fluoride in your floss, right? Alex says, which is worse, bread or sugar for tooth decay? I would say they're equally bad. What would you say to that?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Which is worse for tooth decay, sugar or bread?
Sticky carbs are worse. You know, sugar kind of washes off pretty quickly.
Right, but if you chew that bread up, it's going to get stuck.
Yeah, I have a great slide I didn't include in this, of this society that they found, a cave-dwelling society from 15,000 years ago, and they basically ate acorns. Everything was acorn-based. You know, they made patties of them. They did all this stuff, and they found all these cooking things that they used for it. And they were the mouths of these people were like, I don't know, demonstrations of dental pathology. I mean, they had abscesses. They had cavities. They had, it's horrible to look at. Now I wish I'd thrown it in, but that's from a sticky carb because there was no sugar. I mean, sugar didn't come along until 14,000 years later for these people. This was acorns, and they're not even all that sweet, but they were sticky carbs.
Yeah, they're starch. They break down into sugar. Someone said, how does bread give you cavities? Bread is just starch. When you start to chew up bread, you have an enzyme in your mouth called amylase that literally breaks the starch down into pure sugar from the bread before you even swallow the bread. So I think a lot of people they just don't have a clue about this stuff, that even the most coarse stone ground, non-GMO organic, emmer wheat or einkorn wheat bread is just pure sugar. People think it's something magical, but it's just starch, which is long chains of sugar stuck together.
Yeah. We're going to see some of that in a minute, too.
Yep, this is
another thing that the farmers had, that 13 times as many farmers as hunters is this weird thing. People don't really know what it is, but it was a periosteal inflammation. It was, around the bones and probably painful, probably yaws, a treponemal disease, kind of like syphilis is. But the farmers had it out the yang, and that's usually a sign of poor nutrition.
Yes,
so absolutely. This comparison of agriculturalists and hunter-gatherers is just another tool that anthropologists and archaeologists have to determine what ancient people ate. And these studies that compare hunters and gatherers and farmers or agriculturalists are really enlightening.
And so Dreamcatcher hasn't been paying attention, Doctor. He says that their teeth rotted because they weren't brushing their teeth. Dreamcatcher, honey, listen, pay attention. The hunter-gatherers also didn't brush their teeth, but they had virtually no cavities whatsoever. Anyway, I'm sorry. I just had to address
that. That's all right. I think we got one more slide in this series. So the other findings in this study, the life expectancy was lower among farmers, infant mortality higher, more farmer children than factors than hunters. And the anthropologists that did this study said overall, the agricultural hardened villagers were clearly less healthy than the Indian nolers who lived by hunting and gathering. So that was the conclusion. So same area, same era, they all worked hard, they got exercise, they, lived like ancient men did. And the only thing that really separates them is about 2,000 years in diet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now let's talk about this one. This is going to be a good one. Who are these fat people with dad bods?
Yeah, this is another whole area of research, because most of the anthropological specimens that people get are just bones. They don't have any soft tissue. And because of the Egyptians' proclivity for mummifying people, there's this vast laboratory of ancient remains that have soft tissue. And what's interesting about the Egyptians that I've found in delving into this is that if you see their pictures, their painted pictures, everyone is idealized in that. They all, they all have the look, and they all look thin and they all look svelte. But when you see the statuary, it kind of shows them as they are. And so you can see the various statues of all these Egyptians, and you can see that the males all had breasts and they all had bellies. And these breasts come from all the phytoestrogen that they ate in the wheat they ate, which was emmer wheat, which was an ancient wheat. And the Egyptians ate that, and that was their main food. They had a little bit of beef. I mean, they used pigs to tromp seeds into the ground. They used cattle to plow. These were basically valuable animals, work animals, and they didn't eat them. Now, occasionally when they died, they did. So they had a smattering of large animal meat in their diet, but they mainly ate wheat, and they ate some honey, and they ate some oils that they had. But their main source of food was wheat in one form or another. And I went to, I've been to a million Egyptian shows or exhibitions, and they have all these little figurines of people rolling out wheat on them. I mean, they're just all over the place. That was a huge, huge part of their life. And the other interesting thing about it is it was the same across the spectrum from rich to poor, because they did stable isotope analysis on that, and they found out that it didn't matter if it was somebody that was really rich or somebody that was really poor, they all ate a lot of wheat. And
absolutely. And I think a few things are worth pointing out here. I've heard the following arguments. Well, when you look at Egyptian mummies, let me be politically correct. When you look at Egyptians who were mummified, a lot of people think that was just the upper class of people. And that's not true. Basically, because of the Egyptian religion, unless you were an abject pauper,
right,
or a prisoner of war, you got at least some degree,
right,
of mummification. And they lived in a very arid, low humidity environment. So even if you didn't get mummified, we've still got pretty damn good examples of remains from that time. That's number one. Number two, these you also hear out in the, you know, the influencers on the internet. Oh, if you got to stop eating this GMO wheat, this modern wheat, it's been messed with, it's been modified. These guys weren't eating that. These guys were eating emmer wheat, the ancient actual grain, and their dentition, their teeth are terrible. Same amount of cavities, dental abscesses, and you can see the dad bods, and you can see the belly pooches and the man boobs. This is what happens from a plant-based, wheat-based, grain-based diet. And then finally, if you look at the Egyptian diet and the proportions, it's almost exactly what the USDA MyPlate guidelines tell us is the healthiest diet for us to eat. It is literally the Egyptian diet.
Right, exactly. You know, and they got fish from the Nile. They had these elaborate netting systems set up to where they would trap these wildfowl that flew down the Nile. And so they did have some white meat and they did have some fish, but the main item in their diet was wheat. And they issued about 4.5 pounds of wheat a day, or of kind of a coarse bread every day to Egyptian soldiers. And everybody across all economic spectrums ate wheat. And it's, as you see, it didn't do them a lot of good. It didn't do them a lot of good in the way that they looked, and it didn't do them a lot of good health-wise, because when they started doing autopsies on these mummies, they found out that they had, or these people who were mummified, they found out that they had all the same diseases that we do. And if you flip on, I think we can show some...
Yes, let me go to the next slide. Yes, Joe, we will be doing Monday Night Live tonight at 7 p.m. Central on this YouTube channel. It'll be Nisha and I, not Dr. Eads and I. I wouldn't mind it, but I'm sure he'll be busy at 7 p.m. All right. Now, this is also from ancient Egypt.
Right. Now, this is the teeth that you see on the left that are ground down. That is a common finding. That you see that across Egypt, and everybody but the smallest kids. And what ended up happening, in order to grind this wheat, they mixed sand in with it to help the grinding process. And then they had a way to kind of winnow the sand out of it, but they never got it all out. And some got out more than others. And there are actually advertisements from Egyptian times and hieroglyphics about, you know, don't eat Joe's bread. He's got too much sand in it. Eat mine. Ours is sand free, but none of them were sand free. And the sand inside the flour that they made ended up grinding their teeth down. And that's a characteristic look. You'll see that on every Egyptian person who was mummified that you care to look at has that same ground down tooth pattern. And you can see on the right that they had, that's not really a very good thing for showing cavities, but there are a lot of cavities in their mouths too, because they're ground down and because they had the sticky carbs. And even in kids, they had a lot of tooth loss. You can go on. And here, this is actually a fairly young woman, about 39 years old. And you can already see calcium in her subclavians and her carotid arteries and her left coronary artery and her iliacs. I mean, they had heart disease. And there's an Egyptian papyrus that shows a picture of what people have said is the first representation of, you know, sudden death, with this guy all keeled over and everybody hovering over him and the wife, you know, clutching her equivalent of pearls. And it's kind of a sad picture. So they say that nobody knows, but they say that's the first picture of sudden cardiac death. But the Eber's Papyrus, which is basically an Egyptian medical book, describes a heart attack perfectly. I mean, they talk, you know, when a man has a pain in his cardia, it is death threatening him. And it just is, it could have been right out of Harrison's textbook of medicine. So they did have a lot of coronary disease or a lot of vascular disease. And we can go on to the next slide. Oh, that's the final one. Anyway, if you, the Egyptian, the mummy data is just huge. And it essentially all shows the same thing, that they had all these problems, that they were obese. You can see the fat folds in the mummies. You think of them as being thin, but you can see from those pictures of the sculptors that they were obese. They had signs of diabetes. They had, you know, just all the same problems we do, but magnified. And they didn't live all that long. I mean, they lived up into their 50s and 60s, some of them, but that data is really fascinating. And there's a lot of that that you can get in and look at. And now, instead of doing mummies, they're basically throwing them, putting them in scanners and can find out all this great stuff without destroying the mummy. And what's interesting about this mummy data is that they estimate that there are as many mummified Egyptians as there are living Egyptians today. It's a vast database.
Absolutely.
And back in the 1800s, late 1800s and early 1900s, you could, if you'd gone to Egypt, you could have bought a mummy. I have a picture of a guy out selling. Yeah. They were all over the place. They use them to make paper. They use them to make paint. There's a paint, a pigment that's called mummy brown.
Yeah, and they also used ground up mummy parts as a kind of a pseudo quack medicine.
Yeah, exactly.
In England, in some areas.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, the kind of final slide on this is, if you look at the metabolic constraint, the Kleiber stuff that we talked about first, we didn't really talk about modern RTC, RCTs, but when you look at those, if you go to phkuk.org, they have gathered over the last couple of decades all of the studies that compare a lower carb diet to a higher carb diet. And across the board, the low carb diet comes in as more effective in terms of weight loss and vastly more effective in terms of dealing with diabetes. So if you look at the modern RCTs, if you look at the stable isotope analysis, if you look at the hunter versus farmer and the ancient Egyptians, it all points in the same direction, which is basically cut the carbs.
Yeah, cut the carbs. And I've noticed lately, Doc, that a lot of huge plant-based influencers, I'm talking about people at Cleveland Clinic and Harvard School of Public Health and Tufts School of Nutrition, they have started to shift their window of conversation a little bit. They'll still say, well, you need to eat a plant-based diet. But now for people with type 2 diabetes, they might do better on a low-carb diet. And I think that little shift, because before, you know, keto would give you keto crotch and keto butt crack and keto bad breath and all this stuff. But and so it was just like, no, keto will kill you. But now they're like, well, if you have type 2 diabetes, keto is probably a good choice for you. And I think the next little step on the slippery slope will be, well, if you've got fatty liver, probably keto is the best option for you. And now we've got these new FDA approved medications for obesity. So it's probably going to be a while before they finally admit, well, if you're severely obese, you probably need to eat keto. But that's coming somewhere up the road, I think.
Oh, I think it is too. If you look at the number of studies on the ketogenic diet, it has just absolutely skyrocketed.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's over 150 studies going on right now as we speak about using a ketogenic diet as a therapeutic intervention for everything from mental health to metabolic health to even orthopedic problems. Everybody in the PhD MD community, they are studying a ketogenic diet right now. And I tell people, if you think keto's a fad, you just need to go to, what is it, clinicalstudies.gov and look at all the registered studies right now ongoing about a ketogenic diet. Keto ain't no fad. I'm sorry to tell you that.
No, I mean, it's keto, you know, that's the thing that I've been thinking about and talking about for a long time. I mean, they talk about ketogenesis being a process that takes place when you starve. And the it helps you, it bumps gluconeogenesis, and it if you don't eat the carbs, you can induce it, and but they act like that's an unnatural syndrome, basically. And the more I read and the more I study and all this, I think that was probably our native state.
I totally agree. I've been saying at least 2018, I think that being in at least some degree of ketosis is our baseline. If you go back in time, I think that's absolutely true. We can burn sugar. We can break down and burn starch.
Right.
But on a baseline level, I think human beings were in some degree of ketosis virtually every day of their existence.
I agree. And it just is, and when you put people on them, they get better. I mean, almost no matter what's wrong with them, they get better. And so to me, that seems like makes more sense that's the diet that we were evolved to eat. And I have this slide that I do in other shows, where I have the road to good health, which is right here. And that's the road that everybody thinks is good health. And that's where we're on the plant-based, low fat, high carb diet. And over here's the real road to good health. And when you put somebody on this and they get better, then the people that believe in this road think it's a freaky thing.
Yeah. But, like, well, that's just an anecdote. It's like, yeah, but what do you do when you've got 100,000 anecdotes? At what point do my anecdotes become data? I'd like to know. Coffee Mach Spass. Doc, any reservations about 100% carnivore diet? What do you say if somebody just wants to eat only meat and eggs and seafood? What would you say? Is that a healthy diet, Doc?
It is, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, 100%. I've got several videos on this channel. Yeah. About a carnivore diet. And so if you're interested in that, Coffee Mock, check out my videos. And I think every video that Dr. Eade's ever done, even if he doesn't emphatically say a carnivore diet is healthy, I think that you if you've got any sense at all, by the end of his lecture, you're like, oh, so I could eat just meat and I'd be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's got everything. You throw eggs and meat and even dairy products together and, you know, what don't you have?
Exactly. You've got everything you need and you don't have a lot of excess carbohydrates. Doc, I'm so appreciative for you doing this. Tell us, what do you got coming up? Tell us about your newsletter, because I think a lot of people love newsletters. And then I think you and your beautiful bride have a project you guys are working on. Tell us about those two things.
Well, the newsletter is, I've got a Substack. It comes out every Thursday afternoon. It's called, you can go to Michael Eades, michaeleades.substack.com.
Got a link in the show notes.
Yeah, and it's kind of an eclectic newsletter. I veer into topics besides diet, but there's always some good juicy tidbits in there about diet or papers that I've been intrigued by. And then we've got, our book Protein Power was a bestseller way back in the 90s. And so now we started out to update that. We're going to call it Protein Power 2.0. But once we got into it, we found out that there's so much new stuff that it's just going to be a new book. Nice. So we're working on that right now, and it'll be out by the end of this year.
I'm excited to get my hands on that, Doctor. Thank you so much for doing this.
You bet. My pleasure.
Thank your wife for, I know she's had to sit there and put up with listening to you and I run our traps, and I took her husband away from her. So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate your time and your knowledge. Everybody watching this, if you haven't already shared this video could literally change somebody's paradigm, change their mind, change their life. Please share this video. Thank you, Doctor.
You bet. Take care.
Right. See Bye-bye. You next time. Bye-bye, guys.